Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Good evening, children of the night, and welcome to episode 400. Well, we've made it. 400 weeks of terrifying tales. 400 plus hours of audio frights to make the hackles on your neck raise, and the dark corners of your mind a little darker. If you're anything like me, you probably spend a lot of your time listening to podcasts while doing other things. Folding laundry and doing dishes, cleaning house or doing yard work, maybe even while road tripping. And I'm so thankful and proud that you've chosen us to keep you entertained, and maybe even a little on edge, through it all. I won't take us on too deep of a trip down memory lane today, we've had occasion to do that a number of times in the last year already, but I did think the intro for today's episode was a great opportunity to take a short audio cruise through our history. After so many episodes, it's easy to get attached to the familiar strains that lead you into our dark tales each week when you hit play. I'd like to give a huge shout-out and heartfelt thank you to Diane Severson for serenading our listeners into each episode with her haunting melody. It's been a pleasure to have you as part of the podcast, Diane. Hitting episode 400, it seemed like the perfect opportunity to introduce a little something new to the audio mix, in the way of a new theme. Produced by the incredibly talented and just generally awesome guy, Jared Robinson of Nebulous Entertainment. I've had the pleasure of working with Jared on multiple occasions through my day job as an advertising creative. So when it came time to find someone to help define the sound of the next evolution for Tales to Terrify, he was the first person to come to mind, the one I most wanted to work with. Now, just bear with me while I geek out on this for a second. What I love about the new theme that you heard at the end of our intro is the nuance and layering of different styles of horror and use of themes and elements that remind me of different legendary horror tracks. It provides a perfect introduction to the wide range of tales we produce each week, from gory slashers to cerebral twists of the mind to haunting gothic atmospheres. Jared's done a tremendous job of capturing the diversity of our genre, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. But as far as contributors to the podcast, I can't let this milestone pass by without a few words about those that help bring the podcast to unlife each and every week. The unsung heroes behind our terrifying tales. We've had so many talented authors and narrators contribute to this podcast that I could take an episode just listing off names. And while I'd love to highlight a few long-standing contributors, especially from our host of volunteer narrators, who donate their time solely out of the blackness, goodness of their hearts, my fear is I'd risk leaving someone out. So suffice it to say, narrators, each and every one of you, you bring voice to our tales and character to our words. I can't express how grateful we all are for the passion and craft you bring to each tale you tell. Without you, we'd have a whole lot of dead air to fill. Which brings me next to our staff. Again, the individuals that have been part of the podcast in more than 7 years of existence, each has brought an incredible sense of passion to Tales to Terrify and shaped it into what it is today. From founders Tony Smith and Larry Santoro, to editors like Philip Oldham and Scott Silk, and all those others who came before. And then there's our former host, Stephen Kilpatrick, who I'm pretty sure at points single-handedly kept the podcast alive by letting it suckle at his very soul. In fact, Stephen was kind enough to share a few of his thoughts to help commemorate the occasion.
Children of the Night, it has been 400 episodes of Tales to Terrify. I had the honor of being your host for over half of them. I was always impressed with how many people tuned in to listen to our offering of the horrific and the macabre. I once did the math that it is statistically possible that at any given moment during the course of a year, there is likely someone somewhere on our planet listening to Tales to Terrify. That was one of my most amazing realizations I had as your host. This project, started by Larry and Tony years ago, has rang true to so many people. It has accompanied you while you've gone to sleep, while you've commuted to work, while you've cooked your dinners. Our hosts and our narrators have whispered into your ears for 400 episodes. Thanks so much for being with us through all of the seasons of the wonderful Tales to Terrify.
As always, thank you, Stephen. We've had a lot of change since Stephen and then Scott stepped down, followed by our departure from the District of Wonders. Making it all work behind the scenes has been a tremendous amount of work, and no one deserves more credit for that than Seth Williams. He's toiled away helping to make the transition as seamless as possible and make sure the tales we ooze into your ears each week are as spine-tingling and gut-wrenching as possible. Seth pours a lot of effort and care into organizing stories, narrators, and authors, and even manages to squeak in one of his fantastic narrations once in a while. So, thank you, Seth, for everything you pour into this show, week after week. I don't get a chance to say it often enough. Supporting Seth behind the curtain are the newest members of the Tales to Terrify team. Pete Morsellino joined the podcast right as we transitioned out of the District of Wonders, and has provided a ton of help with keeping shows organized and proof listening to stories as they come in. Meredith Morgenstern and Julia Zellman both joined us in the spring, initially as slush readers. But thanks to their passion for and dedication to the genre, they've expanded their roles to lend more consistent support on a regular basis. Thank you, Pete, Meredith, and Julia. It's great to have you with us. So, Children of the Night, a brief look behind the curtain, and kudos to those who've helped ferry us across the treacherous waters to where we are today, and are helping to take us forward into the dark depths ahead. 400 episodes behind us, and hopefully 400 more lurking, waiting on distant Stygian shores. We have so many more tales to tell, and we're so proud to have you here on this journey with us. Speaking of tales, I think it's about time we heard some. Our first story for the evening comes from Tim Jones. Tim Jones writes poetry, short stories, and novels. He has worked as a symphony orchestra cellist, junior high orchestra director, and college English teacher. A graduate of Lindenwood University's MFA in Creative Writing Program, he was selected as a juried poet for the 2018 Houston Poetry Fest, and his short story, Hunger, was recently featured in the e-zine, The Siren's Call. Formerly from Texas, Tim and his wife, Cindy, have recently replaced the dysfunction of Houston with the calm, wide-open spaces and cool weather of Laramie, Wyoming. He can be found on his website, wandernaked.com, and on Twitter, at timjones7415. Children of the Night, join me for Tim Jones's Maiden Voyage, a Tales to Terrify original.
There once was a man called Jobus who lived on a farm with his comely daughters, Petra and Pika. The land was flat and barren of trees. If you looked at it from above, you would see only a simple house, a weathered barn, and a small plot of well-tilled land. Jobus woke up one morning to discover that a hair from his nose had grown out long and thick, so much so that it tickled his lip. He tried to pull it out, but it held fast and pained him. So he went about his morning chores and tried to ignore it. By noon, however, you must believe the hair had grown to an otter's length and swayed in the breeze as he worked the soil around the cabbages, tomatoes, and flowers. In this he could not abide, so he sought the counsel of his youngest daughter, who bathed in an aluminum trough near the barn. "Petra," he said, "a hair has sprung from my nostril like the devil's tentacle. I am grateful for your help." Inside, Petra tried in vain to cut the hair from her father's nostril, while Pika's infant suckled her mother noisily nearby. "It is stalwart indeed," Petra said, "and I do not have the strength." Jobus sighed, went to his room, and took a nap, as he was wont to do most afternoons, but not for long.
"Papa!" Pika yelled. "Come quick!"
Truth be told, and indeed, one could not make up such things, when he entered the living space, he beheld his daughter pointing at the very thing that vexed him throughout the morning, now detached and crawling on the floor. It had fattened considerably and looked like a scabrous and unusually lengthy earthworm baked brown by the sun. Silently, they watched it slither to the door, wrap one end around the knob, and let itself out. If you were me and I was Jobus, we'd have taken a shovel to the thing right then and chopped it to pieces. And we would have been wise, too, for Jobus, who'd mumbled, "Let it be, and good riddance, too," when it took its leave, was astonished the next morning to see a tremendous caterpillar in his garden. What had been a worm yesterday was now nearly the size of two horses, a fat, green, rubbery beast with two comical eyes, a trick of mimicry, you know. Its mouth, more like a beak, I'd say, ripped whole plants from the ground in one bite and deflowered Jobus's prized musk mallows with cruel efficiency. His daughters delighted in it. Petra giggled as she played with its red antenna stalks that swayed about and slid in and out of its head like pistons, while Pika reclined into the folds of its skin, wiggling her toes in the air as she held her infant snug against her breast. "Get off that infernal thing," Jobus called, but the girls protested. "It's so friendly," Petra cooed. "And soft," said Pika. So Jobus, who'd always tried to please his daughters, went against his better judgment to take a shotgun to the canker and save them from its trouble and let them play. At sunset, when nothing remained of the garden but small shreds of undigested leaf and scat, the larva climbed to the highest rafter in the barn, hung upside down, and slid from its skin. It floated in the air like a rotting eggplant and cast a lip pink glow on the barn. The pupa squirmed in its chrysalis. Liquid seeped from it and formed stalactites that dripped gently on Petra and Pika as they slept below it on a bed of straw, the infant snuggled tight between their bodies. Jobus considered what might be inside this dark womb, and whether now would be the time to move the girls inside and set fire to the barn. But sleep took Jobus far away before such wisdom could transpire. When morning sun cast shards of light onto their faces, Jobus and his daughters yawned and stretched. The cocoon was gone, but outside, in the middle of the yard, was the most fantastic thing they'd ever seen. A butterfly, with wings as tall as the house, boldly marked with stark red circles. Petra and Pika squealed with excitement when they saw it, handed the infant to Jobus, and ran to it, their nightgowns flailing, their long hair blowing in the wind. The imago purred when they approached, a whirring whisper, gazed at them with glass-black eyes, and tickled their legs with its feather antennae. The girls, enchanted, pet the cashmere fur of its abdomen, touched its cold steel legs, and stroked its leathery thorax. It lowered its wing, beckoning them to ride. "May we, Papa?" Before Jobus could answer, the girls had climbed upon the creature's back, and with a jump and flap it rose high in the air, where Petra and Pika smiled and laughed with abandon, as they gazed down at the house, the barn, the garden plot, and Jobus, holding the infant as he watched his daughters vanish into the horizon. Where it took them, and what it did, he could only imagine.
That was Tim Jones's Maiden Voyage, as read by T.F. Ahmad. T.F. Ahmad is a writer and narrator from Chicago. His fiction has been published in Dark Futures and Soiled magazine. He now podcasts his own strange fiction at The Night Bulletin. Search for it on your favorite podcast app or YouTube. Follow him on Instagram at The Night Bulletin. Thank you, T.F.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Our second story tonight comes from Jeremy McGargy. Jeremy McGargy has always loved dark fiction. He cut his teeth on R.L. Stine's Goosebumps series as a child, and a fascination with Stephen King's work followed later in life. Jeremy weaves his tales of personal horror from Martinsburg, West Virginia, with his cat Lazarus acting as his muse/familiar. Listen with me, children of the night, to Jeremy McGargy's The Homunculus, a Tales to Terrify original.
First few moments of cognitive existence. I think of it not as a birth, but as a creation, a sort of bleary replication of life awoke me, and I found that I was mildly revolted by my own form. I feel that I lack the words to describe myself. But the words come when I least expect them to. Perhaps a side effect from my maker. I started life in a petri dish, and the ingredients of my formation might disturb the layman. A bit of sour semen shot from the tip of a frustrated cock, powdered sunstone, magnet, green tuscia, and sulfur that burns the nostrils. This mixture swirled in the womb of a cow, extracted from the maker's local butcher shop, and it curdled and festered under the red warmth of ever-present heat lamps designed to nourish the cold blood of reptiles. But it was not until the swine blood was introduced, with an eyedropper in small amounts, that I began to develop into something more than just a putrid-smelling mess in the maker's cluttered room. The iron of that blood satiated something in me, and through satiation, I became self-aware. I was nothing much to look at in the beginning, just an amorphous blob of chemicals and biological matter in the hollowed-out core of the bovine womb. But with effort, warmth, and, dare I think it, love, that precious word called life was bestowed upon me. It is old alchemy to create a homunculus. The text of my making archaic and vague, and the maker was forced to hypothesize and adapt his methods to his own modern world. But the will was there, and much can be accomplished in the wake of willpower. The first breath of my globular lungs brought a pleasant smile to the maker's face. It bloomed among the cratered pimples and patchy facial hair, turning his prepubescent visage momentarily beatific. It was my first look at happiness, manifested in a human expression. But I did not see it often because the Maker feels that emotion so rarely in his own existence. His feelings delve into a darker spectrum. All that I know of misery, anger, self-loathing, and despair, I learn from him, and how I wish it was within me to leech those thoughts from his head so that his burden would no longer be so great. It is a strange thing to come into the world and to realize that your God is terribly flawed, a broken creature struggling for meaning and some sort of piebald companionship, not a divine and all-knowing entity, but something frail of flesh and sinew, and just as shocked at the success of his creation as the thing that was created. But I do not begrudge my Maker his shortcomings. He had his reasons for attempting this. I was made in a moment of profound desperation, and perhaps it was fate that guided his hand. I think that I was made for a purpose. I know, in whatever slithering pebble of veins and muck that passes for my heart, that I am destined to do something pivotal with the life that I have been given. Because as much as I forgive my Maker for his mistakes, he is a monster, and he is planning something abhorrent, some catastrophic event that waits on the horizon. And if I do not stop him, then I fear no one else will. I have seen him oiling the parts of his AK-47 semi-automatic rifle almost religiously. He spends long hours crafting special holsters for his Glock pistols, and he uses his serrated hunting knife to carve into the leather all the insults that have been thrown against him during his time at Caverno High School. He fingers his hollow point bullets like the secret parts of a pretty girl that he feels that he is forbidden to ever touch or be with. I have watched him breathe deep of the scent of gunpowder, and the aroma alone leaves him intoxicated and swooning in his computer chair. I shivered in fear the evening he received an unmarked package from overseas filled with white phosphorus grenades, and as he played with the pins, I began to realize the true depths of his growing depravity. I saw in him something not quite fully formed, but growing, and if allowed to flourish, I knew it would consume him and rot his soul out, until nothing is left of the Maker but self-destructive ruin. And that is when I first became aware of the nature of evil, how it takes root in a person, twists them just right, and makes of them a malign caricature, a loathing driven into a place of greed and suffering. I saw much of that spreading evil in the Maker, and at times I fancied that I would watch the red burning through him, a color like tendrils of infection invading flesh that used to be healthy and whole. But all moments were not like this. I saw him too when no one else saw him. I saw him leaning forward and weeping until snot dripped from his nose, his teardrops falling into the home of my dish. And I caught each one, sucking it down with a clear approximation of a tongue. And I tasted the genuine hurt inside of him, the unfathomable sadness. I witnessed him staring into the mirror and speaking the most wounding words to himself, words that he had come to believe because he'd been called them so often in his life. Words meant only to downgrade, belittle, and scar the receiver's soul. I saw him tapping the keyboard gently with hopeful fingers, reaching out to friends and family, eager for a kind word or a connection that might dissuade him from his chosen path. But all he ever got in return was judgment or outright silence. No friends, except for ephemeral usernames in cyberspace, and only uncaring family scattered to the four winds. You must understand, I saw both sides of him. The atrocious side, the monster, when he was at his angriest worst. But I also saw the confused, lost boy, the one struggling to hold on to a little optimism, even when he felt like all the walls of his life were falling down to crush him. I am of him, because I come from the sperm of the Maker. The other ingredients are imperative, but is the essence of his seed that animates me. It's said that a homunculus is best cultivated in the dark, but I have known nothing but heat and light, and so the darkness is as alien to me as the moon and the stars. I cannot relate to the dark, and I cannot understand the dark inside of him. It has been 20 of the 40 days. And even though my gestation is not complete, I long to stretch clear bile appendages up into the air and pull myself out of the dish. But I know that the time is not right. I have supped on blood since creation, and I know more each passing day. I am nourished. And I think it is the universe begging me to grow even faster. But the growth of a homunculus is a long process, and it won't happen overnight. I am still little more than a translucent invertebrate, a slimy and sluggish thing with only the most vague human characteristics starting to take shape. The facial features grow the slowest, gelatin eyeballs and a sliver of tongue starting to protrude from the mess. I'll never be like the Maker, because one such as me can aspire only to be a rational animal. But the thoughts of a man roar inside, regardless of stature. Until I can rise up from the biological stew with fleshy legs all my own, I am condemned to do nothing but watch him. I studied him with foggy vision as he brought in the blueprints of his school, plastering them across the wall and making black ink notes across certain sections of the map late at night. I've seen him looming over his yearbook, malign scowl soaked in lamplight, eyes silvered from the moonbeams filtering through the cracked window, and his marker dragging slow circles around faces of fellow students. He writes little words beneath some faces, and the more I grow, the more I learn. Slut. Asshole. Bastard. Bitch. Whore. Motherfucker. The ones he hates the most, the ones that feel the spreading wrongness inside of him. Sometimes I think that I can see that wrongness because of what I am. It looks like a tumor to me, pulsating just behind his heart, and it dances with thin black tentacles, caressing his spirit and provoking his wrath. This is not a physical ailment, but a sickness of the soul. If he is not given the antidote, my maker will be remembered for something inhuman. It seems strange to me that humanity can be capable of such inhumanity, but I should not puzzle over something I was never meant to understand. If discovered, I suppose both my maker and I would be considered aberrations of nature. Him for his repellent plans, and me for existing in such a revolting form. We are outsiders, he and I. Cursed to look in, but never given an invite. Standing on the sidelines, but with no option to participate. It is the aloneness that hurts the most. I wish I could encourage the vocal cords to form, because if they did, I would tell him that I understand his pain. I would whisper to him that, even though it often feels like he is alone in this world, he isn't. There is help. There is goodness. There are lights that glint in the dark, and sometimes the sources are what you would never expect them to be. It doesn't have to end with violence. Violence begets violence, and hurt breeds only more hurt, like a cloud of botflies that cannot be contained. Once the buzzing is allowed to start, once the bullets are spent, once the blood is flowing, and once the screams scorch the halls, comfort will not come. The Maker will find no peace in the pursuit of sanguinary obliteration. I must grow. Is it too late to show him that it is not too late for him? My childhood has passed, and with it the blob-like form of my infantile stage. I have reached a state of malformed adolescent now, and the Maker has transferred me to a new home. I have outgrown the petri dish tucked into the cratered hollow of the cow womb, and from that ragged crimson hole I now reside in a large glass jar that swirls with a mixture of formaldehyde, sulfur, and chunks of stringy beef. I can tell, during each feeding, that the raw meat provided comes from the same cow that the womb is excavated from. So in essence, I am devouring what remains of my mother on a daily basis. A morbid thought, but that is the requirement to ensure the successful growth of a homunculus. My form has evolved, and I'm something now that resembles a fetal shape that is affected with harlequin ichthyosis. I stare at the world from bloodied nub ocular holes, and my tender pink flesh is scabbed over with scales, like skin growing in reverse, the epidermis turned inward and the organic structures flipped outward. Hands are starting to take shape, but they are three-fingered bulges, the thumbs plump and inlaid with curved talons. I float in this personal swamp, the liquid cloudy, and I don't think the Maker's aware of the full extent of my transformation. He often squints into the jar for a better look, but I shy away from him, feeling ever so naked and ashamed of my incomplete body. He certainly has no idea that I am a thinking animal with a mind that expands constantly. I believe that he views me as just a lump of pulsating viscera, and I am sure that he thinks this experiment was a failure. I long to communicate with him, but speech is still beyond me, and I'm scared that I'll frighten him with gurgled ramblings of the indecipherable sort. I've noticed another strange ability. Perhaps it is a combination of my alchemistic hatching and preternatural senses, but I can see into the Maker's memories when he is close to the jar. It's like reaching out with an invisible tentacle and tugging them into my mouth, and each one brings with it the taste of images and emotions. They are disjointed and not linear, but they paint quite a picture regardless. I see him spend late evenings at the firing range, squeezing trigger after trigger, pumping lead into stationary targets while fighting to hold back the tears in his eyes. I see him sitting in his car and watching the sunset, watching couples hand in hand. And I feel the raw anger and confusion that he feels. He wishes he could have what those couples have, but he doesn't know the first thing about how to get it. I see someone who is so completely lost, so untethered from reality, and it's clear to me that this massacre he's planning is just his version of a scream in a crowded room. He wants people to see him. He wants to give voice to his rage and his sorrow. He wants someone to pay, anyone to pay. And he isn't even aware of how doomed and misguided his machinations are. And then there are the other private memories. The ones where he tries desperately to talk himself down from this ledge. I've seen him drive to the ocean front, stagger across the beach, and debate for over an hour about throwing the duffel bag filled with explosives and firearms into the vastness of the sea. He battles with himself, trying so hard to figure out how to forgive, but there is no one there to guide him, no one to show him a better way. He doesn't really want this. He feels like he must do this. The circumstances of his miserable life seem hopeless, and he sees no destiny but one that ends with humans riddled in bullets, bleeding and dead, and the Maker kneeling there in the pool of plasma before shoving the barrel of his Glock into his mouth and tasting whatever abyss comes after. It's his hesitation that encourages me, the moments when he truly questions what is to come. It proves to me that he is not all bad, and there's still a salvageable soul in there somewhere, albeit buried under a mountain of sinister thoughts. But that doesn't change things. I have to stop him. It's up to me to end this madness before it starts. I am just a little monster in a jar, born of cum and a fevered mind. But I'm all that stands between Caverno High School and annihilation. It must be me, the monster that he made. The faithful light of dawn has arrived, and it is the morning of the Maker's final masterpiece. He's packing up his assault rifle and his grenades, so driven and distracted that he doesn't even notice my bulbous body pressing up against the insides of the jar, making the glass strain on all sides. I'm much too big for it now, and it seems my growth spurt is hitting on a major scale. Now and again, little pops sound from the jar as spiderweb cracks travel through the little sides, and the Maker is so in the zone that the sounds don't even register in his ears. He's not focused on his homunculus. He is focused only on the sweat collecting across his palms and the dark and dirty work that he has yet to do. He pulls the black baseball cap down low across his wild mane of brown hair, and he wipes the perspiration from his hands off on his jeans before slipping on the tight leather gloves. There's a tremor in his grip when he slides the duffel bag up over one shoulder, and he tries his very best to ignore it. He takes a look around his room, this nest of inward thoughts and troubled fantasies. He gives me only the most cursory glance. He seems momentarily wistful, as though he realizes this is the last time he will ever look on these walls, this ceiling, and this private haven again. When he shuts the door behind him, it's like he's shutting the door on a future he'll never get to experience, a life he'll never get to lead, and a big, wide world that he feels will never come to embrace him. For the Maker, there is finality in the act. But for his homunculus, the journey is just beginning. I sense when the Maker leaves the home. I hear when he loads his secret weapons into the Uber's trunk, and I contort outward when the sound of the engine fades down the street. I push, splaying my appendages against the glass, and after consistent pressure, the jar explodes, shards flying all through the room in a maelstrom of broken glass. Sour liquid leaks to the floor as I flop from the remains of the jar and land on the carpet. I feel flesh overlapping flesh. I feel veins, ventricles, and loops of fabricated intestines boiling over each other, making of me a meat vehicle that is capable and strong. My form is elongating, and I roll against the carpet, caught in something like a seizure of sensitivity. Before fists can even fully form, I beat them against the floor, pounding out a symphony of biological transformation. Something rushes into the sacs inside of me, expanding sacs, and I realize they are my little lungs becoming large, the air forcing them to balloon and causing torrents of bile-splattered breaths to expel from what passes for a gaping mouth. I suck at the air like a fish out of water, and for the first time, I discover a voice inside of me.
It comes out in a howl that shakes the foundations of the house, a heart-rending wail at this state of creation, words all trying to rush out together in a volcanic eruption of misshaping vernacular. Grisly hands with dripping digits of meat reach for furniture in the room, and I pull myself to a vertical position, shambling into something that resembles the stance of a hunched man. I tower now, my hydrosalaphic head almost smashing up against the ceiling. I no longer suffer in the prism of my own smallness. I have reached the final stage of the homunculus, all the arcanum of my making coming to fruition. I turn the heaviness of my head in the direction of the door, and I crush it outward, fleshy foot meeting wood. I pass through the threshold, loping through the house and out into the misty light of the morning. There's still time.
Christopher waits for the Uber to pull away, the ground mist of the dawn still coating the asphalt of the school parking lot. He wanted to get here especially early, a chance to settle himself into the empty halls and wait for the other students and faculty to arrive. This is the moment he's been planning for almost a full year, and the emotions are all blurring together inside of him. Trepidation, rage, lament, a negative cycle full of black thoughts and each one worse than the last. He leans down and unzips the bag before he can lose his nerve. He retrieves his AK-47 and holds it tight to his bosom, caressing it like the only lover he's ever known. It gives him no comfort. He zips the bag back up and slings it across his shoulder, and he is just about to march across the parking lot to his fate when the silhouette of someone or something appears in the mist before him. It comes shambling out of the gloom, detaching itself from shadows, a towering giant of deformed proportions with the physiology of something that is wholly unnatural in this plane of existence. It glistens wet in the light of dawn, bile, offal, fishy clear fluid dripping down from contusions and unspeakable orifices. Its head is a great bulbous burden across shoulders that are studded in something that resembles crocodile scales. Christopher draws in terrified breath, and he makes the realization that it's his own homunculus that stands in front of him. This is the culmination of a desperate experiment that he never expected to succeed. This hideous thing, built of sperm and nourished with pig's blood, standing here like a sentinel of suffering, uneven arms clearly powerful enough to crush bones into dust. It's almost like the universe sent it here. It stands directly in the path, preventing Christopher from completing his diabolical work. So, this is how it ends. Christopher faces down his own creation, the monster he made, the homunculus that he forced a shred of unwanted life into. He sighs and he lets his haunted eyelids flutter closed. He spreads his arms outward. He wonders how much it will hurt to be torn apart. He wonders if the monster will kill him quick or eat him alive, chewing down his emotions with each voracious bite. It will be a bitter meal. All the good is already cored out, and only the unhappiness remains. The homunculus stalks closer. It smells of blood and soil and life born from death. Christopher feels those enormous arms embracing him, pulling him close, and he waits to hear the subtle crack of his own ribcage. He waits for the serrated maw to open, the jaws to extend, and the crooked teeth to break his skin. He is accustomed to darkness, and he waits for more of it. The pain doesn't come. The monster does not increase the pressure of the embrace. Christopher's eyes flit open in shock, and he realizes something that breaks him inside. The homunculus is not attempting to hurt him. It has wrapped him up in a hug, an embrace, a sign of kinship, an act of love. Something so utterly foreign to Christopher that he barely recognizes the gesture. It has never been shown to him before. To his astonishment, the monster's mouth opens and words bubble up from the deep hollow of its sternum. This is not the way. Christopher's reaction is delayed, but when it comes, it overtakes him completely. His body trembles in the arms of the homunculus. He begins to sob, no longer hiding his brokenness, but letting it show, letting the vulnerability out. He is only able to do this because it's clear that the monster cares. He weeps freely, tears rolling down his cheeks, and he returns the embrace, wrapping his arms around the wicked mapwork of flesh that serves as the monster's back. He buries his face into the monster's warm shoulder, and he lets himself cry. He lets it out in a flood, and it's like his mind is purging itself of all the nastiness that's been allowed to grow there like a festering bacteria. At some point, the semi-automatic rifle falls from Christopher's hands to clatter against the asphalt, and the boy makes absolutely no move to pick it back up again. It felt oily and poisonous in his grasp, and he was glad to let it go. He lets it all go. He lets it all out. His soul soars so high that it seems to touch the clouds, and for the first time in ages, he smiles. No gunfire pierces the silence. No blood stains the asphalt. No screams carry in the dawn. There is only the mist and the prevention of a terrible and costly mistake. The mist rolls thicker across the parking lot. It obscures all, washing clean, making new. The boy and his homunculus welcome it.
That was Jeremy McGargy's The Homunculus, as read by Scott Fulps. Scott Fulps is a narrator and voiceover artist. When not disturbing your dreams with tales of horror, Scott can be found in Washington, D.C., where he works as a restaurateur. He currently resides in that most haunted of commonwealths, Virginia. Thank you, Scott. Next up, I'd like to share with you the first chapter of a classic tale of the struggle between good and evil that wars within all of us. This first chapter was released last week to our amazing supporters over on Patreon. We'll be rolling out new chapters every week, so if you like what you hear, hurry over to patreon.com/talestoterrify to sign up. This is just the first of many bonuses we'll be releasing, along with ad-free episodes. So there's never been a better time to sign up and help us make the next 100 episodes the best batch yet. Tonight, I'm excited to share with you the first chapter of one of the most influential gothic horrors of all time. A story from Robert Louis Stevenson. Robert Louis Stevenson was born in 1850 in Edinburgh, Scotland. He traveled often, and his global wanderings lent themselves well to his brand of fiction. Stevenson developed a desire to write early in life, having no interest in the family business of lighthouse engineering. He was often abroad, and while he loved to travel, many of his trips were for health reasons, and his journeys led him to his early literary works. In fact, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was a story originally inspired by a terrifying dream. Publishing his first volume at the age of 28, Stevenson became a literary celebrity during his life when works such as Treasure Island, Kidnapped, and The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde were released to eager audiences. Children of the Night, join me for Chapter 1 of The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Chapter 1. Story of the Door. Mr. Utterson, the lawyer, was a man of rugged countenance that was never lighted by a smile, cold, scanty and embarrassed in discourse, backward in sentiment, lean, long, dusty, dreary, and yet somehow lovable. At friendly meetings, and when the wine was to his taste, something eminently human beaconed from his eye, something indeed which never found its way into his talk, but which spoke not only in these silent symbols of the after-dinner face, but more often and loudly in the acts of his life. He was austere with himself, drank gin when he was alone to mortify a taste for vintages, and though he enjoyed the theatre, had not crossed the doors of one for 20 years. But he had an approved tolerance for others, sometimes wondering, almost with envy, at the high pressure of spirits involved in their misdeeds, and in any extremity inclined to help rather than to reprove. "I incline to Cain's heresy," he used to say quaintly. "I let my brother go to the devil in his own way." In this character it was frequently his fortune to be the last reputable acquaintance and the last good influence in the lives of down-going men. And to such as these, so long as they came about his chambers, he never marked a shade of change in his demeanour. No doubt the feat was easy to Mr. Utterson, for he was undemonstrative at the best, and even his friendship seemed to be founded in a similar catholicity of good nature. It is the mark of a modest man to accept his friendly circle ready-made from the hands of opportunity, and that was the lawyer's way. His friends were those of his own blood, or those whom he had known the longest. His affections, like ivy, were the growth of time. They implied no aptness in the object. Hence, no doubt, the bond that united him to Mr. Richard Enfield, his distant kinsman, the well-known man about town. It was a nut to crack for many what these two could see in each other, or what subject they could find in common. It was reported by those who encountered them in their Sunday walks that they said nothing, looked singularly dull, and would hail with obvious relief the appearance of a friend. For all that, the two men put the greatest store by these excursions, counted them the chief jewel of each week, and not only set aside occasions of pleasure, but even resisted the calls of business that they might enjoy them uninterrupted. It chanced on one of these rambles that their way led them down a by-street in a busy quarter of London. The street was small and what is called quiet, but it drove a thriving trade on the weekdays. The inhabitants were all doing well, it seemed, and all emulously hoping to do better still, and laying out the surplus of their grains in coquetry, so that the shop front stood along that thoroughfare with an air of invitation, like rows of smiling saleswomen. Even on Sunday, when it veiled its more florid charms and lay comparatively empty of passage, the street shone out in contrast to its dingy neighbourhood, like a fire in a forest, and with its freshly painted shutters, well-polished brasses, and general cleanliness and gaiety of note, instantly caught and pleased the eye of the passenger. Two doors from one corner, on the left hand going east, the line was broken by the entry of a court, and just at that point a certain sinister block of building thrust forward its gable on the street. It was two stories high, showed no window, nothing but a door on the lower story and a blind forehead of discoloured wall on the upper, and bore in every feature the marks of prolonged and sordid negligence. The door, which was equipped with neither bell nor knocker, was blistered and distained. Tramps slouched into the recess and struck matches on the panels. Children kept shop upon the steps. The schoolboy had tried his knife on the mouldings. And for close on a generation, no one had appeared to drive away these random visitors or to repair their ravages. Mr. Enfield and the lawyer were on the other side of the by-street, but when they came abreast of the entry, the former lifted up his cane and pointed. "Did you ever remark that door?" he asked, and when his companion had replied in the affirmative, "It is connected in my mind," added he, "with a very odd story."
"Indeed," said Mr. Utterson with a slight change of voice, "and what was that?"
"Well, it was this way," returned Mr. Enfield. "I was coming home from some place at the end of the world about 3 o'clock of a black winter morning, and my way lay through a part of town where there was literally nothing to be seen but lamps. Street after street and all the folks asleep, street after street all lighted up as if for a procession, and all as empty as a church, till at last I got into that state of mind when a man listens and listens and begins to long for the sight of a policeman. All at once I saw two figures, one a little man who was stumping along eastward at a good walk, and the other a girl of maybe 8 or 10 who was running as hard as she was able down a cross street. Well, sir, the two ran into one another naturally enough at the corner, and then came the horrible part of the thing, for the man trampled calmly over the girl's body and left her screaming on the ground. It sounds nothing to hear, but it was hellish to see. It wasn't like a man, it was like some damned juggernaut. I gave a few hello, took to my heels, collared the gentleman, and brought him back to where there was already quite a group about the screaming child. He was perfectly cool and made no resistance, but gave me one look, so ugly that it brought out the sweat on me like running. The people who had turned out were the girl's own family, and pretty soon the doctor for whom she'd been sent put in his appearance. Well, the child was not much the worse, more frightened, according to the sawbones, and there you might have supposed would be an end to it. But there was one curious circumstance. I had taken a loathing to my gentleman at first sight. So had the child's family, which was only natural. But the doctor's case was what struck me. He was the usual cut-and-dry apothecary of no particular age and colour, with a strong Edinburgh accent and about as emotional as a bagpipe. Well, sir, he was like the rest of us. Every time he looked at my prisoner, I saw that sawbones turn sick and white with the desire to kill him. I knew what was in his mind, just as he knew what was in mine, and killing being out of the question, we did the next best. We told the man we could and would make such a scandal out of this as should make his name stink from one end of London to the other. If he had any friends or any credit, we undertook that he should lose them. And all the time, as we were pitching it in red hot, we were keeping the women off him as best we could, for they were wild as harpies. I never saw a circle of such hateful faces. And there was the man in the middle, with a kind of black sneering coolness. Frightened, too, you could see that. But carrying it off, sir, really like Satan.
If you choose to make capital out of this accident, said he, I am naturally helpless. No gentleman but wishes to avoid a scene, says he. Name your figure.
Well, we screwed him up to £100 for the child's family. He would have clearly liked to stick out. But there was something about the lot of us that meant mischief, and at last he struck. The next thing was to get the money, and where do you think he carried us but to that place with the door? Whipped out a key, went in, and presently came back with the matter of £10 in gold and a cheque for the balance on Coutts's, drawn payable to bearer, and signed with a name that I can't mention, though it's one of the points of my story. But it was a name at least very well known and often printed. The figure was stiff, but the signature was good for more than that if it was only genuine. I took the liberty of pointing out to my gentleman that the whole business looked apocryphal, and that a man does not in real life walk into a cellar door at 4 in the morning and come out with another man's cheque for close upon £100. But he was quite easy in sneering.
Set your mind at rest, says he. I will stay with you till the banks open and cash the cheque myself.
So we all set off, the doctor and the child's father and our friend and myself, and passed the rest of the night in my chambers, and next day, when we had breakfasted, went in a body to the bank. I gave in the cheque myself and said I had every reason to believe it was a forgery. Not a bit of it. The cheque was genuine.
Tut, tut, said Mr. Utterson.
I see you feel as I do, said Mr. Enfield. Yes, it's a bad story. For my man was a fellow that nobody could have to do with, a really damnable man. And the person that drew the cheque is the very pink of the properties. Celebrated, too, and, what makes it worse, one of your fellows who do what they call good. Blackmail, I suppose. An honest man paying through the nose for some of the capers of his youth. Blackmail House is what I call the place with the door, in consequence. Though even that, you know, is far from explaining it all, he added, and with the words fell into a vein of musing. From this he was recalled by Mr. Utterson asking rather suddenly,
And you don't know if the drawer of the cheque lives there?
A likely place, isn't it? Returned Mr. Enfield. But I happen to have noticed his address. He lives in some square or other.
And you never asked about the place with the door, said Mr. Utterson.
No, sir, I had a delicacy, was the reply. I feel very strongly about putting questions. It partakes too much of the style of the Day of Judgment. You start a question, and it's like starting a stone. You sit quietly on the top of a hill, and away the stone goes, starting others, and presently some bland old bird, the last you would have thought of, is knocked on the head in his own back garden, and the family have to change their name. No, sir, I make it a rule of mine. The more it looks like Queer Street, the less I ask.
A very good rule, too, said the lawyer.
But I have studied the place for myself, continued Mr. Enfield. It seems scarcely a house. There is no other door, and nobody goes in or out of that one, but once in a great while, the gentleman of my adventure. There are 3 windows looking on the court on the first floor, none below. The windows are always shut, but they're clean. And then there is a chimney which is generally smoking, so somebody must live there. And yet it's not so sure, for the buildings are so packed together about the court that it's hard to say where one ends and another begins. The pair walked on again for a while in silence, and then,
Enfield, said Mr. Utterson, that's a good rule of yours.
Yes, I think it is, returned Enfield.
But for all that, continued the lawyer, there's one point I want to ask. I want to ask the name of that man who walked over the child.
Well, said Mr. Enfield, I can't see what harm it would do. It was a man of the name of Hyde.
Said Mr. Utterson.
What sort of a man is he to see? He is not easy to describe. There is something wrong with his appearance, something displeasing, something downright detestable. I never saw a man I so disliked, and yet I scarce know why. He must be deformed somewhere. He gives a strong feeling of deformity, although I couldn't quite specify the point. He's an extraordinary-looking man, and yet I really can name nothing out of the way. No, sir, I can make no hand of it. I can't describe him. And it's not for want of memory, for I declare I can see him this moment. Mr. Utterson again walked some way in silence and obviously under a weight of consideration. "You are sure he used a key?" he inquired at last. "My dear sir," began Enfield, surprised out of himself. "Yes, I know," said Utterson. "I know it must seem strange. The fact is, if I do not ask you the name of the other party, it is because I know it already. You see, Richard, your tale has gone home. If you have been inexact in any point, you had better correct it."
"I think you might have warned me," returned the other with a touch of sullenness.
"But I have been pedantically exact, as you call it. The fellow had a key, and what's more, he has it still. I saw him use it not a week ago." Mr. Utterson sighed deeply, but said never a word. And the young man presently resumed, "Here is another lesson to say nothing," said he. "I am ashamed of my long tongue. Let us make a bargain never to refer to this again."
"With all my heart," said the lawyer, "I shake hands on that, Richard."
That was Chapter 1 of Robert Louis Stevenson's Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, as read to you by Graham Dunlop. Graham Dunlop is an application solution architect and voice artist. Despite his somewhat mixed accent, he was born in Australia. He finds narrating immensely satisfying, as it can turn a good story into a great experience. He lives in Melbourne, Australia. Thank you, Graham. Well, children of the night, the sun has set on our 400th episode, and we're excited to explore the darkness ahead. We've got plenty of spine-tingling, blood-curdling, and mind-altering tales in the works that are sure to make your nights a little more sleepless. Want to help us keep growing the podcast? Love what you hear? And wish there was something you could do to say thanks? Well, you're in luck. Head over to Patreon, and for as low as $5 a month, you can gain access to ad-free episodes, bonus content, like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and have first dibs on any and all news and contests oozing down the pipe. That's patreon.com/talestoterrify. Or, if you'd rather throw us a few bucks via PayPal, you can find a link near the bottom of our homepage to do just that, talestoterrify.com. Want to support us, but you don't have the spare change to do it? You'd be surprised how much a simple review or rating can do for our show. Take a minute and share your thoughts about our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Reviews help us spread the darkness, so we can infect new ears with our terrifying tales. Tales to Terrify is produced by Seth Williams, Pete Morsellino, Meredith Morgenstern, Julia Zellman, and of course myself, Drew Sebastini, with original theme music by Nebulous Entertainment. Tales to Terrify is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. Join us again next week as we infest the deep recesses of your mind with more Tales to Terrify.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.